I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. There are reports that the Obama administration is considering authorizing a lethal strike against an American citizen living in Pakistan and alleged to be plotting terrorist attacks against the United States. This administration's first targeted killing of an American citizen was carried out in 2011 against Anwar al-Awlaki, who had ties to al-Qaeda in Yemen. In the last few years, questions have been raised about targeted killings, including executive power, the deliberation process, judicial and congressional oversight, and the legal and moral justifications for their use. So today in Radio Times, does the president have the authority to target and kill American citizens overseas? We are joined by two guests. Michael Lewis is a professor at Ohio Northern University, where he teaches international law and the law of war. Michael Lewis, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Also with us, Claire Finkelstein, and she's the Algernon Biddle Professor of Law, also Professor of Philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, where she's also Director of the Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law. And Claire, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty. It's a pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you both here. And Michael, if I could begin with you, is this a new debate that we're having, and is it new because we have things like drones?
I'm not sure that it's because we have things like drones and as much as because we have knowledge. We know more about who it is we are targeting than perhaps we have in the past. There's no question that in the past, the executive and the U.S. military have killed American citizens that were fighting for foreign forces. We killed a number of American citizens during World War II who were fighting in the German and Japanese armies. And there was no question at that point about whether their due process rights were being violated or any question about that. I think part of the reason why we're doing that today is just because we know exactly who it is that we're targeting.
By name.
We have names, yes. And I think that at least feels different. I don't think that it changes the president's power or authority to do so, but it does feel different.
What do you think, Claire?
I don't think the technology has changed anything. Drones are the latest incarnation of precision weaponry, and the issues that we have about the president's authority to target individuals is just part and parcel of the president's war powers and the debate surrounding that. However, the major change is that we have a different kind of enemy and a different kind of war. And that's what's really making the difference in this debate.
Because a different kind of enemy, we're not fighting a country, and that makes a different kind of war?
That's right. So members of al-Qaeda are non-state actors. They are individuals who do not belong to any government. They are not authorized by any government authority. And that's new for us in terms of warfare.
We are, though, talking, I mean, broadly about a number of things, but talking very specifically about the idea of targeting American citizens. And I'm wondering, from your perspective, Michael, do these citizens have any rights?
Do they have any rights to
due process, for instance?
I don't believe so. I think that once they are positively identified enemies, if you are a member of al-Qaeda or associated forces, and that is the sort of scope of authorization that Congress has given to the president to use his war-making powers. And to be clear, the only way that this can happen is through the use of his war-making powers. The president cannot target American citizens overseas at his own discretion. It is only against groups that Congress has authorized him to do so against.
And this is the authorization to use military force, which was signed by Congress or was passed by Congress after September 11th.
Exactly right, yes. It was done in October of 2001. One of the arguments against this authority allowing him to do this would be that that authorization just talked about those that plan and participate in 9/11. However, since then, there's been a judicial gloss placed on that definition in the habeas cases that has essentially said al-Qaeda and associated forces. I think the court's reasoning there is that a group as diffuse as al-Qaeda changes its name, changes its location. The president should not have to return to Congress and ask for authorization to go after each new group just because they change their name or location, as long as they are still trying to kill Americans either here or overseas.
Do you think that wording is too broad, Claire?
The wording of the current AUMF is very broad, and there's discussion about whether or not the AUMF should be refined and reauthorized. Many people try to draw conclusions from the fact that Congress has not reauthorized the AUMF, which I don't think is legitimate to draw. But I think it's correct that the president does not have sufficient guidance under the current broadly worded statute for us to really identify whether or not targeted killing strikes against Americans is legitimate in this case.
Because we're talking about imminent threat or something called continued imminent threat, the idea that the threat could be ongoing.
Well, there's a lot of confusion around the notion of imminence in this area. Normally, the notion of imminence applies to law enforcement. And here we have the justification offered that targeting American citizens abroad in outside the zone of hostilities is legitimate because we're in a war and they are combatants. However, it is not clear for the reason that I gave earlier that we are in a war and that they are combatants.
Mm.
They're non-state actors, and traditionally the concept of a combatant has been limited to individuals who are acting in the name of a state. So that's the issue that the AUMF does not give us any guidance about, and which we badly need guidance on.
Do you think are we at war, Michael?
Yes, we are at war. I think that the question of there's a term of art. Combatants is a term of art, and they are not combatants. To be a combatant, you have to be a member of an armed group, and international law says you have to be a member of an armed group that enforces the laws of war. Because being a combatant gives you certain privileges as well as certain mm-hmm. detriments. One of those privileges is to use force against your enemies without criminal prosecution. So you kill someone or you blow up a building, that is not arson or murder as long as you're following the laws of war. But our opponents, Al-Qaeda and the like, do not enforce the laws of war against their people, so they are not quote-unquote combatants.
Right.
However, you can still be a targetable individual under the laws of war if you are a positively identified enemy of an armed group, whether or not they are complying with the laws of war. The term for that in the ICRC, the International Committee of the Red Cross, gave some interpretive guidance on what it takes to be targetable. And there's a term called a continuous combat functionary, a CCF. And they say that an individual that is sort of constantly farmer by day, fighter by night, if you continually act that way, at some point you lose your civilian immunity because of the fact that you are functionally acting as a soldier. It doesn't mean that you get the combatant's privilege, but it does mean you become targetable. And that's who we are targeting. We are targeting what you would call CCFs, continuous combat functionary members of Al-Qaeda and associated forces.
Let me quote something the president said last spring. He made this very famous speech about exactly what we're talking about. And Claire, I'll get a response from you. The president said, when a U.S. citizen goes abroad to wage war against America and actively plotting to kill U.S. citizens, and when neither the United States nor our partners are in a position to capture him before he carries out a plot, his citizenship should no more serve as a shield than a sniper shooting down on an innocent crowd should be protected from a SWAT team. That's, you know, one of the things that he said in that speech. Your response?
Yeah, well, that was from his speech at the National Defense University, and this was a really important speech because it was the first time that the president or that anyone from the administration had really come out and said, we need to have guidelines for the use of targeted killing and for war. And it was interesting, however, that he gave that example because somebody who is a sniper, we have rights whether we're at war or not at war. That's a matter of self-defense or of defense of others. We don't need to invoke a war framework in order to shoot a sniper who's posing an imminent threat. But traditionally in the law of war, if someone is a combatant, the threat that he poses does not have to be imminent.
Mm. So mixing, because he's at war, he's a combatant.
Because we're at war with that person. So a combatant can be targeted 24/7, a true combatant. So if you think, for example, of the Second World War, an American soldier, a German soldier, the American soldiers have the right to target the German soldiers 24/7 at any time, whether that person is imminently posing a threat. They can be asleep, they can be in the movies, right? But here we're talking about imminence because we're not actually in a combatancy framework, a pure combatancy framework. We have a kind of mix of frameworks. Law enforcement on the one hand, military context on the other, and that's posing a difficulty.
Yeah, go ahead, Mike. You want to say something?
I think that what we have here is a mix of legal and policy considerations, and you have a variety of speeches. That the most important, as Professor Finkelstein mentioned, was the NDU speech by President Obama, but you can go back to those given by Brennan and Co. and Holder in various times over the last 2 or 3 years, and you cobble them together and see this is the basis, these are the standards we are using. And imminence comes in, I don't believe, as a legal requirement, because as Professor Finkelstein says, this is confusing in some level, because imminence is the language of law enforcement.
Sure.
Imminence is not
sure.
the language of warfare. I think what we are saying is, if it's going to be an American citizen, we want to choose, for policy reasons, not legal or constitutional reasons, to heighten our scrutiny somewhat and say there has to be a level of imminence. It's not going to be the same as sniper imminence, but it is going to be, you are a continuing threat. And I think I've heard the term continuing imminent threat. Those words don't seem to really go together, but the idea that Brennan, I think, most particularly articulated was that if you have a window of opportunity and you let that window close, by the time you see them again, they may already have done something quite horrific. And so you don't have to give up an opportunity to kill someone today because they are not about to set off a bomb if they have set off bombs in the past and you have reason to believe they will set off bombs in the future.
We're about a minute before a break here, but it seems to me, though, Claire, we are dependent always in any kind of combat situation on intelligence. And if a president has this authority, he better have the right information.
Absolutely. Information is very critical, and many people say this is a war of information because it's been so important.
But you know, there have been intelligence failures in the past and intelligence mistakes in the past as well.
Right. So, of course, targeted killing will be only as precise as the intelligence on which it's based. And that's not a problem specific to the use of drones or specific to this war or, as it were, military-style interaction. It is a problem that's endemic. And there will always be mistakes made. There's nothing wrong with drones per se, insofar as they allow us to be more precise in the targets that we hit. There will always be collateral damage, even with drones, however, and a lot of the controversy about drones does have to do with collateral damage, and that may be a little bit of a confusion as well.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about this question. Does the president have the authority to target and kill American citizens overseas? Claire Finkelstein is the Algernon Biddle Professor of Law, also Professor of Philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, Director of the Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law. Michael Lewis is with us as well, Professor at Ohio Northern University, where he teaches international law and the law of war. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet @WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Allentown Symphony Orchestra presents Mozart's Requiem Saturday, March 8th at 8 p.m. and Sunday, March 9th at 3 p.m. Often referred to as his swan song, Mozart's final composition, Requiem, remains one of his most popular works. Introducing the newly formed Allentown Symphony Chorus. Also, cellist Christine Lampria will be featured in Barber's Cello Concerto. Information at millersymphonyhall.org. The Allentown Symphony Orchestra proudly supports WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now,
I feel kind of lonely.
We'll remember a young girl who shared her struggle with cancer online and continues to brighten other lives.
Confusion is very, very high on my list of feelings right now.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY and presents the Summer Academy, July 7th through August 1st, a program designed for talented and motivated high school students. PAFA's Summer Academy is a 4-week college-level art-making experience in the nation's first school of fine art. Registration is open now, and space is limited. Details about PAFA's Summer Academy are available online at pafa.edu/summeracademy. pafa.edu/summeracademy.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Michael Lewis and Claire Finkelstein about whether the president has the authority to target and kill American citizens abroad. And Lewis is going to be debating this issue tonight at the National Constitution Center, obviously joining us here in our Philadelphia studio. And again, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Mike, you wanted to talk about drones.
And intelligence. I think that was one of the questions. How good is the intelligence? Your targeted killings are only going to be as accurate as the intelligence you're using, and that's where drones enter into things. While drones do execute targeted killings, their primary function is surveillance. And one of the rules that we have for any targeted killing is you have to have followed this individual for at least 72 hours prior to actually firing on them, because you have to make sure that they are doing the things that put them on the list. This is not us just taking the word of somebody in Pakistani intelligence or a tip from somebody. You verify it, and you verify it with surveillance, and the surveillance can actually greatly decrease the likelihood of the kinds of mistakes that you don't want to make. And drones are critical in that role.
Claire, you wanted to expand on this notion of due process. Go ahead.
Well, I think that's one of the most interesting and most difficult questions here. In the al-Awlaki case, when Nasser al-Awlaki, the father of Anwar al-Awlaki, learned that his son was on the joint prioritized effects list, the targeted killing list,
right,
he filed suit in the District of Columbia to enjoin the killing, meaning to stop it, to have it stopped. And the judge who issued the opinion in that case denying Nasser al-Awlaki's request said that this is a political question. Nasser al-Awlaki had claimed that his son's due process rights were being violated. And the court said due process does not play any role here under something called the political questions doctrine, meaning this is a political question. It's left to the president and to Congress through their authorization of the use of military force to decide. Given that we are not in a full, normal, standard military conflict, that argument appears to me and to many people to be very weak, and to say that not that your due process rights are not being violated, but that you can't even assert your due process rights. Courts have no jurisdiction and have no say in the matter is an extreme position to be in. So that's the question that's now arising again with Abdullah al-Shami, whether or not he might have due process rights and therefore ought to be treated a little bit more like a criminal, namely have the right to an attorney, have the right to confront accusers against him, and most importantly, have the right to know why he is being targeted to die.
And this is the person in Pakistan that the Obama administration is deciding, I guess, whether to kill him or not.
That's correct. And I think that the reason he's on the list, from what I know of it, is that he is an expert maker of improvised explosive devices, and those are the leading killers of U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan, and he is very effective at making them in ways that they can penetrate armor and they can do more damage. He has skills that most people don't have. This is not an average munitions worker. This is someone who is very effective at helping them kill American soldiers. Now, the idea of the political question doctrine and saying courts don't have a role in this, I mean, this is exactly where courts come out when you're at war. Right? The executives capability, the executive's discretion in how he wages war has always been exclusive. You do not have courts or Congress, once they have authorized war, ever getting in the way and saying, this is how you have to fight it.
Because
it has never happened.
Chief?
He's commander-in-chief. That's his job. And the check on that is Congress is giving him the authority to do it. And Congress can pull that authority away at any time they choose to. But it's not for the courts to say, this is who you can or can't go after, or these are the limitations in how you go after an individual, American citizen or otherwise.
Well, let me pick up on that, because, you know, it's hard to imagine, if we are at war currently, it's hard to imagine this war will ever end, because there will always be terrorists who will want to do bad things to Americans or to try to attack the country. So are we going to be forever in a war footing, and does that sort of rebalance some of these balance of powers
in our government? Yeah, that's another problem. And one of the ways in which warfare or our conception of warfare has been changing dramatically. We seem to have a loss of time in warfare. Wars used to have clear beginnings and clear endings, and we no longer have that. There used to be a clear battlefield. We knew exactly where the zone of hostilities was. There used to be clear enemies and clear combatants on the other side, and the status of individuals involved in war used to have a clarity to it that it no longer mm-hmm. does, once again, if we consider this a war. So there's a vagueness about the nature of war, and that is particularly what concerns me with the expansion of executive authority over these matters and the deference that courts are playing to the president. We may be permanently changing the nature of presidential power over the lives of American citizens.
You go ahead, Mike.
I don't think that this is that much different. The nature of the war is different because the nature of who we're fighting is different, and that's their responsibility, not ours. The reason why the boundaries of the battlefield or who the enemy is not clear is because our enemies are making it not clear. They hide amongst the civilian population.
But
they
that's
don't
how they
wear
fight
uniforms.
This war, though, isn't
they
it?
Use human shields, right. They do these things. And for then us to say, well, that means that we have to give them even more rights and even more protections than a German soldier would have because the Germans were playing by the rules, essentially, seems like a great incentive for enemies to further endanger the civilian population by hiding amongst it and pretending to be that.
But didn't we excuse my ignorance here, but didn't we pass a law banning targeted assassinations? I mean, this was during the Vietnam era.
Executive order.
The
executive order was that you may not, and this was in a reaction to assassinating foreign leaders, right? That's sort of the idea, the executive ban on assassinating foreign leaders. And that was brought up, actually, in the first Gulf War. There was a question, could we target Saddam Hussein? Or would that be an illegitimate assassination? And I think that the answer to that was he's their commander-in-chief. I mean, quite honestly, President Obama is a legitimate target of an enemy of ours in wartime because he's the commander-in-chief of our military, just as a general or an admiral would be a legitimate target. And in the same way, a leader that is the head of the military is a legitimate target.
Go ahead.
Right, that's correct. So an assassination is of a head of state, and what we're talking about here is not an assassination. And it's also clear that the United States has to be able to protect itself against terrorists, just like it has to be able to protect itself against any kind of threat to national security. So the real question is, what kind of framework are we dealing with here? And there are very old principles of war from hundreds of years ago in what we refer to as just war theory. And the most important principle that pertains to our current discussion is what's called the principle of distinction. The principle of distinction says that combatants can be targeted at any time, and civilians may not be targeted. And I agree with Professor Lewis that, of course, Obama, as the commander-in-chief, is a legitimate target because he's a member of the armed forces, but civilians are not legitimate targets. So how do we think of all the individuals involved in this diffuse organization, Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula? Which ones are civilians? Which ones are combatants? We have started to revise all of our categories, and once again, we find ourselves betwixt and between, sort of between a law enforcement framework and a military framework.
Well, and just picking up on that, and something you said earlier, Michael, I mean, you could be, you know, a shepherd by day and a member of Al-Qaeda by night. So who are you?
And that's exactly right. I think what we see, and again, these are, I think, policy restrictions we want to place upon ourselves rather than legal restrictions in saying this is what we need to do to ensure who you are and what you are. I think legally you'd say someone that is, the other term is direct participation in hostilities. If a civilian is directly participating in hostilities, they forfeit their immunity for such time as they do so and may be targeted. Now, that goes beyond the moment they're firing their gun. Interestingly, Al-Qaeda is aware of what we do and what we say our rules are. In Fallujah several years ago, during the fighting there, they clearly demonstrated an understanding of our rules of engagement. because when a fighter got in a position where he had to displace, it's the most dangerous time is when you're moving from one place to another, he would openly throw his weapon down and then run, knowing that our rules of engagement at that time said he's not targetable because he's not participating in hostilities at that moment. Of course, he'd run to another place where there's another weapon, pick up, and keep firing. Right. And we have since revised our rules of engagement to say as long as you can continually track someone, just because they put their gun down and start running doesn't mean that you can't target them. And so we have to be careful about how much detail we give our enemies because they're listening and they will change their behaviors in order to try to take advantage of our restraint.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and I know, Claire, you want to say something. Talking with Michael Lewis and Claire Finkelstein about targeted killings. This is, of course, a difficult but important topic to be discussing, having to do whether the president has the authority to target and kill American citizens. That happened a couple of years ago with an American citizen who was in Yemen with ties to Al-Qaeda in Yemen, and apparently there are discussions in the White House about an American citizen living in Pakistan that is reportedly or allegedly working to target American citizens. Claire, you want to add something, then we'll get to our callers.
Yes, I think we've slipped a little in our discussion from talking about whether or not American citizens are entitled to constitutional protection under the Due Process Clause when they may have an involvement with Al-Qaeda or the associated forces of Al-Qaeda, to the question of the rules of engagement and whether or not we ought to be adhering to the traditional rules of war. And so Professor Lewis was just talking about the fact that if we adhere to the traditional rules of war, we can be exploited by members of Al-Qaeda who know, for example, that if you throw down your weapon, you cannot be fired on. And so the question that this raises is a different one from the due process question. It's the question of whether or not the fact that the enemy is not adhering to the rules of war should release us from the duty of adhering to those rules.
And what from your
perspective? My position is that it does not. So under the law of military intervention and the rules of armed combat, we have a duty under international law to adhere to the rules of war no matter what the enemy does. That is the traditional position, that is the traditional law. Once we start ignoring the rules of engagement and the traditional rule of law in this area, war becomes lawless. And it's a very dangerous position for us to be in because it's, of course, a downward spiral.
Go ahead, Michael, and then I promise we'll get to our callers and our...
She's absolutely right that just because the other side does not follow the laws of war does not exonerate us from or excuse us from not following the laws of war. We are still bound by those. But there's a difference between the laws of war saying you cannot target a civilian and rules of engagement, which are more restrictive than the laws of war, and they're saying this is how we interpret that. We had interpreted direct participation in hostilities to be sort of while you're firing. Now, there is nothing in the laws of war that says direct participation in hostilities ends when you stop firing. And we have now, and you can certainly easily interpret it to say, well, actually, when you're coming and going from the fight, when you were doing these other things, you're still directly participating in hostilities, and we've just expanded the zone of what our rules of engagement allow us to do. Where the boundaries of that are, what exactly constitutes direct participation in hostilities, is a very contentious legal issue. But I don't think anybody would argue that a fighter running from one position to another to get another weapon is not still directly participating in hostilities. And we're not violating the laws of war by targeting him.
Claire, we had a tweet earlier with someone essentially saying, why not then take away this person's citizenship, go through that process of taking away their citizenship, and then I guess they wouldn't be seen as an American citizen, and whether that opens up possibilities. I'd be curious about your thoughts about that.
That's become much discussed recently in what the standards are for denying someone citizenship. You can see that from a due process standpoint, there would be a problem with that. Because if you think that, say, Anwar al-Awlaki had due process rights and that he didn't have a chance to have heard in court, whether you think they were violated or not, and that he had a right to have those due process rights aired in court and a right to his day in court, as it were, then stripping his citizenship in order to assure that he doesn't have his day in court would be an illegitimate way to proceed.
I got you,
And just one quick thing on that before we go to our callers. And that is that all of these individuals do have a way of vindicating their constitutional rights. They can walk into the U.S. consulate and say, you know, take me, try me. Right? If Anwar al-Awlaki had shown up at the U.S. consulate in Yemen, we could not have killed him. He would have been a prisoner. We would have captured him, and then he can have his day in court. Al-Shami has the same option. And they can vindicate their constitutional rights by showing up and standing trial.
Go ahead. I need to answer that one,
yes,
because
please.
That's not quite correct. Nasser al-Awlaki, Anwar al-Awlaki's father, argued, look, my son wants to turn himself over to law enforcement authorities, and he's not able to do so, because once you are on the targeted killing list, you poke your head out of your cave or wherever you happen to be hiding, and it may be shot off. Now, the new guidelines that the administration has produced suggests that capture is of primary importance and that we are committed to capturing before targeting. Mm. And that, I think, was the right way to go, once again, assuming that we're in a mixed or a law enforcement framework and not in a pure combatancy framework.
Let me get, looks like Barbara from Malvern to join our conversation. Barbara, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, hi. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I guess I wanted to say that, to me, the argument breaks down a bit if you consider that in the United States, hate speech is not tolerated. There are certainly white supremacists and other groups who advocate violence and killing. They're not asked to walk into the jail and turn themselves in. I mean, if they're captured and arrested, they're put on trial. And I think that the same thing should have happened to al-Awlaki. The second thing is there hasn't been any mention of the other gatherings where people have been killed en masse. They were apparently very bad intelligence there. Funerals, weddings, apparently, you know, no one guilty of anything there, and entire families wiped out. And also hasn't been mentioned, how about al-Awlaki's son?
Mm-hmm. Who was killed as well.
What was he guilty of?
Barbara, those are all really good questions. About a minute before our break here, let me put the hate speech question to you, Michael.
Well, we couldn't capture al-Awlaki. Yes, someone who is guilty of hate speech can be captured and tried in this country. Al-Awlaki was guilty of a lot more than hate speech. He was an operational leader that was involved in the Fort Hood shooting, in the Detroit underwear bomber attempt, in the Times Square attempt, right? So he was involved in a lot more than just hate speech. But he was targeted because of that, and we could not capture him. Had we been able to capture him, if he was not hiding out in the places in Yemen that he was hiding out in. And you have to remember that Yemen is involved in a civil war, and Anshar al-Sharia and al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula control meaningful portions, or had controlled meaningful portions of the country at that point. So it's not like the Yemeni government could go get him for us either. And we can talk more about the civilian casualty side of drones on the other side of the break.
Absolutely. Barbara, we will pick up on the other points you wanted to make on the other side of the break, as Michael Lewis just said. And again, professor at Ohio Northern University, teaches international law and the law of war, graduated from the Navy's Top Gun School back in 1992. And he'll be part of a debate tonight at the National Constitution Center. Also with us, Claire Finkelstein, and she's the Algernon Biddle Professor of Law and Professor of Philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, where she directs the Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law. I know you want to say something after this very short break. 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
CHF, the Chemical Heritage Foundation, supports WHYY. This first Friday, March 7th, CHF welcomes Mary Seaton Corboy, head farmer at Philadelphia's Greens Grow Farms. Are cities still concrete jungles? This concept is being reconsidered in 21st century America. Information on how community gardens and urban farms are playing a growing role in the sustainability movement, bolstering foodie culture, and anchoring local food hubs. More information online at chemheritage.org/firstfridays.
He never got to Mars, but he pushed us all to get there, despite his criticisms of science education in the U.S.
Science, which is so successful, which is responsible for our lives in most cases, is so poorly understood.
We'll talk with Ann Druyan, wife of the late Carl Sagan, executive producer of the new TV series Cosmos, next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Beethoven's only concerto for the violin is as much about the orchestra as it is the soloist. The Philadelphia Orchestra is joined by Nikolai Schneider for Beethoven's violin concerto. Also, Stefan Denev conducts Shostakovich's 10th Symphony. Tickets online or at 215-893-1999 today. March 6th, 7th, and 8th at the Kimmel Center, Beethoven's Violin Concerto with Nikolai Schneider and the Philadelphia Orchestra.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Michael Lewis and Claire Finkelstein, both on and off the air, about this important issue that we're talking about. Does the president have the authority to target and kill American citizens overseas? It's a question that has raised a whole host of other questions having to do with executive authority and the role of the courts, the role of Congress. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes at WHYY. WHYY.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Claire, do you want to just make a comment?
Professor Barbara's Lewis call? Just said that it was legitimate for us to target Anwar al-Awlaki because he would not turn himself in. It's not clear that we ever gave him an opportunity to turn himself in. And once again, if you think about this in a law enforcement paradigm, the police don't have the right to just start shooting at a suspect. They have to try to apprehend that suspect. Now, I think back when al-Awlaki was killed in September of 2011, the Obama administration was not as clear as it is now about the importance of capture in this context. Once again, I think the fact that the administration is stressing capture before kill is a recognition that we are not dealing with a traditional combatant situation.
So it'll be interesting to see what, I guess, options are offered to this American citizen who's in Pakistan now, whether it will be capture or kill.
That's right. And under the new guidelines, one would expect that the case might be handled differently.
Although capture is far more difficult than you think. If you think about what it took to do the bin Laden raid, right, that was a very high risk. We lost a helicopter there. We didn't lose any individuals, fortunately, but that's a very high risk enterprise. And there are an awful lot of civilians that could be killed in a situation like that. So capture is not that easy, and it is fraught with an awful lot of perils, not only for our own people and the target, but also for any civilians that happen to be in the area.
Let me get a caller in because he wants to talk about something that actually Barbara had mentioned earlier. This is looks like Mark from Tioga joining us on Radio Times. Mark, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome.
To return back to the point of al-Awlaki's son, from what I'm given to understand, his son was basically an American citizen as well, skateboarder, et cetera, who had gone to Yemen looking for his father. And not knowing at the time that his father was killed. He's sitting at like an outdoor restaurant with some of his cousins when the drone comes over and kills them all. When a comment was made about the fact that not only had you killed the target, but now you had in a separate strike killed the target's son, if I'm not mistaken, someone in the administration made a comment along the lines of, well, he should have had a better father.
Well, you know what, Mark, let me take your point, because it's an important one, and it's an important one especially to discuss part of this conversation about mistakes that were made, whether, you know, he should have had a better father or not. I don't think we can answer that question.
No.
But nonetheless, he was not a terrorist, and he was apparently looking for his father in Yemen.
Well, nor was he a target. He was not the target of that strike. There was an individual in al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula who was the target of that strike, who was killed, and al-Awlaki's son was in the vicinity and was also killed. And there are times in which people who are not targets are killed. They are collateral damage is the way the term is used. And some of that happens in wartime, and it happens in wartime whether you're using drones or special forces or artillery or manned aircraft. Anything will cause collateral damage at times, and drones actually cause far less of that. We heard one of the other callers talking about weddings and funerals,
right,
and mistakes,
right,
that are made, and it happens, right? Mistakes are made, and they are highly publicized. But if you look at the number of people killed by drones, civilians killed by drones, as a percentage of total, compared to other forms of warfare, drones at this point in counterinsurgencies are the most discriminating form of warfare best at distinguishing between fighters and civilians of any kind. I can talk about statistics at some point for your viewers to, listeners to look at, but they are the best at distinguishing between civilians and fighters.
Let me throw something sort of keying off of that to you, Claire, which is one of the criticisms of drones and the fact that civilians do and have died in a drone strike is that they become then a recruitment tool for more people who want to do ill against the United States, whether they want to join Al-Qaeda or some affiliated group. And I guess, I mean, the question is are the strikes, I guess, you know, worth the kinds of risks?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, anytime you have a use of force, you have the possibility of collateral damage. And the fact that there's been mistaken targets or collateral damage with the use of drones doesn't speak against the use of drones per se, because if the strike is legitimate, then it's going to be some kind of weaponry. So people tend to blame technology on things that are really human decisions. I try to focus much more on whether or not targeting this individual is legitimate under the law of armed conflict, or under whatever legal framework we're operating in, rather than focusing on the technology. In theory, once again, if the use of drones allows us to be more precise in the strikes that we make and allows us to reduce the amount of collateral damage, then they're a good thing, as compared with, say, aerial bombardment that we've engaged in throughout history. You know, when we...
Dresden, for instance.
When we leveled Dresden, right, exactly. Those are that's highly imprecise weaponry.
But I'm wondering, if the situation were reversed and there were a Pakistani citizen in the United States and this citizen, you know, wanted to organize a terrorist attack against the Pakistani government or even the president of Pakistan, would we, Michael, allow Pakistan to come into our airspace and take this person out with a drone?
Well, the standard that we're talking about and the standard that we utilize when we talk about quite honestly, infringing on Pakistani sovereignty. There's
exactly.
No question that drones going over and killing people in Pakistan is an infringement on Pakistani sovereignty unless they are giving us permission to do so. And I think there is plenty of evidence that they are. But even if they are not, and let's take that as an assumption right now, there is an unable or unwilling standard that we have talked about that has been used in other circumstances where you have a duty as a sovereign state as well as privileges, and one of those duties is to prevent your territory from being used as a base of operations by those that are striking other states. And you need to do something about that. And if you are either unable to do that, which was Lebanon's situation with Hezbollah in 2006, the Israelis said, look, stop the rockets. And Lebanon basically said, we can't. If you're unable, then Israel has a right to defend itself across the border. So that would be the unable standard. The unwilling standard would be bin Laden, right? They had to have known he was there and they weren't doing anything about it. And so if you're unwilling to stop your territory being used, then again, we have a right to do something about that. So if Pakistan came to us and said, here's a terrorist leader and these are the things that he has done wrong, get him out of your country. And we say, no, we're not going to do that. Yes, I believe that they do have the right to then take some kind of action.
What do you think, Claire?
This is a very difficult question, the question of what I would call horizontal sovereignty. Because if we ask Pakistan, can we come into your country and attempt to capture someone who is plotting against the U.S., and they say no, are we then entitled to send a drone in to target that person, or is it a violation under standards of international law of their sovereignty? That question is really remains an open one in international law. So that was also the question with regard to Anwar al-Awlaki. We need a better understanding of what the boundaries of sovereignty are under international law and whether or not drones, action at a distance, can substitute for boots on the ground.
Let me get to it. Looks like Charles from Bucks County to join our conversation. And Charles, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. My question is in the targeting. Especially in tribal areas in Pakistan and Afghanistan and Iraq, how do you stop local feuds spilling into information that the CIA or the NSA gets and then targets people that had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. They were just enemies of somebody else in that tribal region. How do you stop that? And also, has that in fact happened?
Well, it's, I think a number of the detainees that ended up in Guantanamo were sort of the victims of that, and that there were conflicts, local conflicts, and someone turned someone in and said that they were terrorists, and they ended up at Guantanamo. This is a complicated question.
That's true, but I think that what I talked about earlier, the surveillance side of this has changed that largely. You may have been someone who you get a tip because there's a tribal conflict that they are trying to carry out and using the U.S. to do their dirty work for them. But the bottom line is our drones then follow the individual and figure out if they are in fact doing the kinds of things that make them targetable. And if they're not, then we do not strike them. If they are, then the intelligence has been confirmed, and it is appropriate for us to strike them. But it is far less likely that we are going to be doing those kinds of strikes based on tips and intelligence that doesn't bear out, because we actually verify it ourselves.
But do you think it's possible for a drone to follow someone for a couple of days, Claire, and figure out whether they're terrorists plotting against the United States or not?
It always has to be with the assistance of human beings. Once again, I think it's not a matter of the technology at issue, though surveillance drones have very much increased the accuracy of our information, but enhanced our general ability to gain accurate information. But, for example, we have two kinds of problems in accuracy. We have picking the wrong target, right? We mistake someone for a terrorist, they're not a terrorist, and then we've killed an innocent person. And then there's the kind of collateral damage where somebody is in the area of a legitimate strike. And target drones, weaponry, can help with one, but not with the other.
Right. Let me get, looks like Duran from South Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Duran, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. My question is, why aren't we treating these people like common criminals? They murder things, they blow things up, they commit crimes, and we're calling it, yet we're giving them recognition as like terrorists, which I think gives them too much credit. Why don't we use the laws that we have that punish criminals like that instead of, you know, making them soldiers or enemy combatants like that? Thank you.
You're welcome, Duran. Go ahead, Claire.
Yeah, and one way of amplifying on your question, sir, is the war on terror fundamentally different in structure from the war on drugs? Should we think of the war on terror as really a sort of international law enforcement problem? Now, the way that we think of the war on drugs. Now, it's very difficult to engage in effective law enforcement internationally because we don't have real international institutions to help with international criminal law and with real enforcement in that area. One answer to some of the problems that we've been dealing with is to try to strengthen international criminal law so that we do have more effective collaboration among countries and that we don't constantly run into the issue of lateral sovereignty or horizontal sovereignty as an obstacle to effective law enforcement.
You want to respond to that? I'm thinking of also the cartel leader that was just captured in Mexico, for instance.
Right, and if you can capture him, if you're in a place where, of course, the Mexicans have a police force, their police force works with our police forces, and to the extent law enforcement can do that, that's fine. And I have no problem with capturing people and trying them for their crimes. But in places like the Badlands of Yemen, where it is very difficult for law enforcement to get and where there is a lack of control, or even more importantly, the Fatah regions of Pakistan. And it's important to understand, Fatah is not fully part of Pakistan. It's part of its sovereignty. It is a sovereign nation, part of their territory. But it is not the people there are not covered by the Pakistani constitution. Law enforcement does not work there in the same way as it works in the rest of Pakistan. There are no police in Fatah. Law enforcement is done through a government agent from Islamabad that deals with tribal conflicts and decides what the criminal or civil outcomes of things are. And then those are enforced by tribal militias. There are no police there. And so the idea of saying we're going to do law enforcement in Fatah is not possible, at least not now. Someday, maybe, but not now.
Go ahead, Claire.
But it's a mistake to say that, look, law enforcement is very difficult in this context, to saying, therefore, someone who may have due process rights because he's an American and entitled to the protections that Americans have when they are accused of a crime, will not have those protections. We can't have the difficulty of law enforcement determine what tools it's legitimate for us to use any more than the police could do that domestically. If we could, imagine that the same argument might hold on American soil. So we could say, all right, look, it's really hard for us to arrest this terrorist or suspected terrorist who's sitting in Ohio. Let's send a drone into Cleveland because it's just too hard for us to arrest this guy. That argument doesn't wash in the United States, and it doesn't wash in Yemen either.
Go ahead. We're almost out of time, but go ahead, Michael.
But there is a difference between what these people are doing and common criminals in the sense that they are targeting American soldiers, American civilians. Their acts are acts of war. Whether you talk about 9/11, whether you talk about the underwear bomber, whether you talk about Times Square, Fort Hood. I know the Boston Marathon was not connected, but again, you know, that's the sort of thing we're talking about. And those sorts of attacks are acts of war. Certainly, if they were committed by states, they'd be acts of war. And if you have a cohesive enough non-state actor that is doing it, we can treat that as warfare. And then the tools of armed conflict, rather than the tools of law enforcement, are the appropriate way to stop it.
Well, we could go on. The clock is. I know. Darn it. I know you had something to say, Claire. I want to thank you both very much for joining us today on Radio Times, a conversation we could have for another hour. Claire Finkelstein, Professor of Philosophy, the Algernon Biddle Professor of Law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, Director of the Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Also with us, Michael Lewis, Professor at Ohio Northern University, where he teaches international law and the law of war. Thank you very much as well, Michael.
Thank you.
And I should add, he'll be speaking tonight or be part of a debate tonight at 6:30 at the National Constitution Center here in Philadelphia. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.